So we started marching. We went over to Freddie Gray's neighborhood or down to City Hall. We marched every single day after school. And for them, it was that time when all of a sudden, those protest marches at the age of 4 connected to marches in Baltimore. And the times when I would have them make protest posters, it was similar to chanting justice for Freddie Gray.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I am Jessica Hankin.
And I am Laura Wexler.
And this week, we're continuing, a feature we call Return to the Stoop, in which we feature a memorable Stoop story and explore various fascinating questions with the storyteller.
But before we get started, we want to thank Park School of Baltimore, an independent K through 12 non-sectarian school in North Baltimore. So today, our guest is Dr. Kay Whitehead, Associate Professor of Communication and African and African American Studies at Loyola University, and the host of Today with Dr. Kay on WEAA-FM here in Baltimore. So her story is from a 2015 Stoop show we did called Beginnings and Endings. So we're going to listen to the story, and then we're going to have a chat with Dr. Kay Whitehead.
So I consider myself to be a Black mommy activist. And I have a lot of titles that I go by, and this is the one that is the most favorite of mine, because this is the one I gave myself. 14 years ago, when I realized and I had that moment where I noticed that my body was changing, that I looked in the mirror and said, I think I'm pregnant. And I just could not believe it, because I am someone who doesn't believe in having kids. I didn't want kids, and yet somebody had chosen me to be their mother. And so in that instance, I chose to be a Black mommy activist. I said, if I'm going to have children, then I'm going to raise them as Black warrior scholars. I had this idea of a perfect blend of the activism of Malcolm X and Assata Shakur, blended with like the wisdom of Dr. King and Mary McLeod Bethune. So when they were younger, we would have mock protest meetings in the basement. And I was planning for the takeover. We would do sit-in movements in the backyard. And so instead of learning nursery rhymes, we would do freedom songs. 1, 2, 3, freedom for me. 1, 2, 3, 4, freedom for me too, mommy. I'm like, yes, you're being trained to be an activist. Now, I didn't know what I was training them for. I just knew that I wanted them to be ready when freedom came. Because I know that the history of Black folks in this country ain't been no crystal stair. And growing up as Black boys in America, they needed to be ready to defend themselves against any stereotypes that anybody wrote about them. So I knew early on when I said, we're not going to have a TV in the household. Get rid of the TV, because we're doing something even more exciting. We're getting library cards. I said, there's something amazing about the library. And they got on board because they were young. They said, oh, there's something at the library. There's something at the library. Trust me when I tell you. You have to go there. They're going to talk about ER. They're going to talk about television. But you've got a library card. And not everybody has that. So growing them up and watching them take this on, I knew we wanted to make a stand somewhere. Now, my sons have been following the Black Lives Matter movement, and for me, that was my whole life summed up in 3 words. Because I had grown up as a daughter of a civil rights activist, and my dad had spoon-fed me stories of activism along with his peas and corn. So for me, it would be like, oh, Daddy, please, tell me about the time you got arrested. And oh, Daddy, please, what about the time you met Dr. King? So Black Lives Matter meant something to me. And for me, it was more than just a slogan. It was a way of life. It was 400 years of history bookended by pain and hurt. It was a way I wanted to raise my boys. And they kept saying, Mommy, we've got to do something about this. But I didn't know what. They put a poster in their room, and they begin to add names and dates up on the poster. So Trayvon Martin, they put up. And then John Crawford. And then Rekia Boyd. Iyanna Jones. Ezell Ford, Tamir Rice, and when they put up Freddie Gray, they said, Mommy, we've got to do something. So we started marching. We went over to Freddie Gray's neighborhood or down to City Hall. We marched every single day after school. And for them, it was that time when all of a sudden, those protest marches at the age of 4 connected to marching through Baltimore. And the times when I would have them make protest posters, it was similar to chanting justice for Freddie Gray. that all of a sudden every single story I had taught them became real to them. Now, we had some missteps along the way. Like the time when they wanted to take selfies with the National Guard. I'm like, I don't think you can do that. I understand why, but I don't think now was the best time for a selfie with the National Guard. Or when they said, Mommy, we're going to go march with the Black Israelites. We love those purple shirts. I'm like, you know, maybe not that at this moment. Or when they would call me in the middle of the day, we're stomping out of math class because we're not talking about Freddie Gray. I'm like, you still need algebra. So if you stay there, we can deal with the movement at the end of the day. So they had some missteps, but they began to figure it out. And that was an amazing process for me, the beginning of their activism. And so when the dust settled, I asked them, I said, you know, what did you learn? Like, what stuck? And they said, Mommy, we learned three things. The first is that old story you told us about knowing when to jump and when to walk away. Like, we got that. This is a story I told them because I was traveling through Kenya, and I had this really wonderful idea. I was young and stupid. I have to be clear and transparent. I said, I'm going to go down to Zambia, and I'm going to bungee jump over the Zambezi River. My parents weren't there. There was nobody to stop me. So I went down to the bridge. I'm standing there, and the guide says, don't worry. It's only a 111-foot fall. Your face is going to lightly kiss the water. You're going to hang there. And then we're going to come and pick you up. I'm like, that just sounds absolutely insane. So I'm in the bungee jumping equipment. And I'm looking down going, oh, my word, I'm afraid of heights. And this is stupid. I was like, well, I'm scared and stupid at the same time. But I couldn't get down because all around me, everyone's yelling, jump, jump, jump. Why don't you? You're taking up the line. Just jump. So I jumped. And when they cut me down, the guy goes, oh, that was what a ride for you. How was it? I was like, I'm so stupid because I didn't want to jump, and I did. And so I told my boys, is there going to be times in your life when people are going to want you to jump? You've got to know when to jump and when to walk away. They said, nobody understands why we're marching for Freddie Gray, Mommy. Our classmates don't understand. The teachers don't get it. But we're jumping because this is something we feel we have to do. The second thing they said they learned, we learned how you always said, God bless you, and what that meant. Now, that's an old story in our family because when my youngest son was 4 years old, he was playing upstairs in his room, because children do. You hide him away so you can have some quiet time. And so he sneezes, and all of a sudden he yells out, God bless you, Amir. So I bring him downstairs, and I say, Amir, you were by yourself. Why did you say God bless you? I mean, he's 4 years old. He said, Mommy, sometimes when you're by yourself, you got to bless yourself. I said, you do. You do. That was absolutely profound to me. Because sometimes when you're by yourself, you got to bless yourself. I'm telling you, I put that up on my wall. I got a bumper sticker with it made. I'm like, you know what? God bless you, Kay. Like, you're going to be okay. These kids will not drive you crazy. God bless you. But we took that in our family. And so we were going up to the Freddie Gray March. I would hear the boys going, God bless you, Kofi. God bless you, Amir. Getting ready for it. And then they started adding other names. God bless you, Tamir Rice. Your name will not be forgotten. And God bless you, Rakia Boyd. We know you're struggling. God bless you, Freddie Gray. Your death won't be in vain. So you got to know how to bless yourself and when to bless others. And finally, they said, Mommy, we realize you were right. The world does not revolve around you. I'm like, it doesn't, even though I like to think it does. I do. I told them earlier on, I really do believe the world revolved around me and everyone else was just too stupid to figure it out. And they were like, no, Mommy, we realize that the world actually revolves around the sun. I'm like, yes, but you don't have to be the sun to shine. Like, you can change the world right where you are. What I learned through that is kind of what Khalil Gibran in that poem on children, when he wrote that your children are not your children, they are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for itself. I realized that I was a reluctant mommy, and I complained about giving up everything for my boys. And here it is, after watching them struggle and grow and protest and march, I found myself exactly where I wanted to be. A Black mommy activist watching my warrior scholars getting ready to change the world. Thank you.
All
All right. So, well, God, I love that story. Before we get into the discussion, we want to thank two of our sponsors of the podcast, Golden West, which is a vegan, Southwest-inspired restaurant on the Avenue in Hamden, and Baltimore Magazine, which has been a longtime friend to the Stoop. Okay. So, wow. So first off, thank you for being here with us right now to discuss this 5 years later. And wow, so much has changed and yet so much has stayed the same.
What was it like to hear this story again now, 5 years after you shared it, Dr. Whitehead?
It's interesting. And let me first say thank you so much for inviting me. It was an honor and a privilege to actually give my story at the Senator. It was really exciting to have my young son in the audience. And now to look and see that the young son who was in middle school is now a senior in high school.
Wow.
And my high school first year student, he was a first year high school student, is now a sophomore in college, just shows how quickly time has gone by. I remember when my boys were born and my grandmother said, don't blink. Don't turn away. Don't focus on the future. Focus on now. And I'm a very defiant granddaughter, so I blinked. I turned away. I focused on the future. And now here we are where the future is now. And I feel both unprepared and I feel humbled to be able to take a look back at this journey.
What was their reaction to, so it was just the one son that was there that night at the Senator when you shared the story, or were they both there?
Only one son. My youngest son was with me, but because my youngest son recorded it, my oldest son was able to take a look at the recording as well. It was amazing. We often laugh about the stories because we are a family of storytellers. And so the stories I told during the Stoop stories are stories that are told during our family time. And every year I build more to these stories, and being able to take the stories from Stoop Stories, and they ended up in my book, Letters to My Black Sons. It was just a way of trying to share my family stories with the world.
Well, and you know, in this story, it's so memorable, like how you were raising them from the very moment they were taking breath to be warriors, to be warriors for justice, to be, I think you use the word warrior scholars. And, you know, you talk about their early experiences with protests. And I'm wondering, like, in the 5 years since you shared the story, what have you and your sons or your family's experience been with protesting, and what has changed or what has continued?
When I look back at the last 5 years, I kind of see it in two ways. So we have the last 5 years before COVID, when the biggest issues we were struggling with was Black Lives Matter, making sure my boys remained safe, making sure they knew their rights, making sure that they were learning as much as they could, making sure that I was opening up the path for them to be able to dream out loud and pursue the type of future that they really wanted to have. And then there's a part two where I think about life after COVID, where my college sophomore son is back home and taking courses from our living room table. And my high school senior is home all day, taking his classes from his desk in his bedroom. And we're still dealing with what I call now Black Lives Matter meets Black COVID story. So it's not just about staying alive in the midst of a season that we're dealing with intense police brutality and would-be vigilantes coming after Black men and Black women and children. But it's also thinking about the underlying conditions that impact my community. And so what does that mean to see the devastation that COVID-19 has wrought within my community and the ways in which I'm trying to work with my husband to keep our boys alive on two fronts, right?
Yeah.
So it's not just when you leave the house and you deal with police brutality. It's also about this other unseen danger that could be out there waiting at any moment, any place, any hour. And so there are days when it feels overwhelming. And then there are days when I just experience such incredible joy when I look at
who they have become and who they are becoming. When I look at the realization of the seeds that my husband and I sowed into them from the time that they were born. I mean, it's been a beautiful and difficult and hard, but yet fulfilling journey.
Would you say, go ahead.
I was just going to ask if your older son is at college, is he studying physically on campus or is he doing it virtually?
He's doing it virtually. He goes to college in Memphis, Tennessee. And so it was in March of this year. And I tend to spend a lot of time apparently on Facebook and Twitter, just putting my life out every single step of the way. But I remember that weekend that we had to pack up and make what I call a very harrowing journey down to Memphis in 14 hours. We did it straight through so that we can pack him up and sleep in a hotel room and trying to disinfect everything and get back on the road and get back home in one day or so, the 14-hour trip going down one day and then coming back, because it was a fear of COVID-19 and having a disruption to his college first year. And I say all this at the same time understanding that the complaints I'm giving are very light complaints because my family is still healthy and still here.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to complain about, oh, the drive was too long when we've lost over 207,000 Americans. And it's hard to complain, oh, he's, you know, pulling on the Wi-Fi and eating too much food while he's doing classes at our table when 7 million people are infected. So I understand the kind of the framing around what I call these minimal complaints within a situation that is hitting every part of this planet.
Well, and, you know, the story you shared in 2015, it was, there was a lightness to it. There was like an optimism and a hope. And
I mean, even, I mean, not to cut you off, Laura, but even that moment when you first said, like talking about the lightness, when you first said that, you know, we would hold, you know, pretend protest, I think it was, and the audience just, they laughed in a way, I don't know if they would laugh now, you know? And were you surprised at that moment, Laura? I did not mean to hijack your question.
Oh, no.
It's interesting because I tend to use a lot of humor in my speeches because I think that these are stories that transcend people's personal experience, things that we talk about as parents, things that we laugh about, or things that we used to laugh about. Yeah. I think that Black Lives Matter 1.0, which is what I kind of call that first iteration of Black Lives Matter, I don't think many people were plugged in to how challenging and difficult it was. I don't think many people were actually connected in a visceral way in the ways in which they are connected now. So now, if I were to tell that Stoop story and I would talk about having my sons do protest marches in the basement and learning how to do activist work in the backyard when they were 4 and 5 and 6 years old, today, people would shake their heads in agreement because we've seen videos of, you know, PKs and, you know, five-year-olds doing Black Lives Matter marches in all parts of Maryland and predominantly white communities as well. People understand now that what sounded light and was my attempt to kind of share my experience is the reality of what it means to be Black in America and to raise your children to always look over their shoulders, to always recognize that because they are Black or brown in this country, there's an additional level of oppression and hostility and tension. And even within all of that, that there is a search that's needed for joy and for family and for peace that is just as important. When I listen to myself tell that story, I mean, I was light. I was optimistic. I had a lot of hope. I had a lot of humor.
Uh-huh.
2020 for everyone has just been a difficult year. And it's just so hard. And I sit here wondering, just from my own personal revelatory experience, am I still that person? Do I still have that lightness and that hope in the midst of how difficult it really is? And I don't know.
Yeah. What about your sons? Where are they on the sort of optimism versus pessimism continuum?
Well, my college sophomore wanted to be into his second year on campus. He was prepared to grow, to be the college student that we had told him that he was going to be. He's frustrated about being home because this feels as something is lost. I mean, he's going to go back to school in the spring. And he's been told that as a sophomore, there's no housing on campus. So now we're trying to deal with sending him back to his own apartment, which is something that is just difficult for us to have a young person starting their senior year online. I think both of them have a lot more optimism and hope than I do. And I say that because I believe that Generation Z, these millennials, are extremely resilient. I mean, they were born during a time of 9/11. And so even as babies, there was a certain amount of shadowing over them as parents because we had realized what happened on that day. They came of age talking about Black Lives Matter. They marched out for climate change. They marched out because their generation had more school shootings in the 20th century than any other generation. And now here they are, where they're coming of age into the latter part of their teens, hitting their 20s, dealing with COVID-19. They are much more resilient. And they have a belief, a strong belief that this is going to pass and they're going to get through it. And I'm living through their optimism and their hope.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
that's so reassuring and beautiful. Yeah.
It's interesting that you talked about, you know, these sort of two fronts, right? The police brutality and COVID, right? And it's like the thing about COVID, you use this word sort of an invisible threat to them, but, you know, just the huge disparity in who's getting COVID, that it's disproportionately Black and Brown people getting it. And like, how do you protest that? Because it's such a complicated systemic thing, but just to really see that again as more inequality, more things stacked against, you know?
No, and I understand, because the battle we're talking about is not simply going out and marching. I mean, the battle is something that is prevalent and has been prevalent in our community. We're talking about decades upon decades of racism, of white supremacy, of white nationalism that go back to the very foundation of this country. This is what I teach. This is what I talk about in my home. This has been made very clear to my sons. I think that when we were dealing with last year, 2019, my sons and I did a lot of work on the 1619 Project in terms of teaching about it and talking about it. And I was talking about it every day on the radio about the 400 years of Blackness in this country and what does that look like and what is the framing around that. And I don't think things were made clear until we really took a look at the COVID-19 numbers. What does a food desert do to Black and Brown people? What does it mean when you live in very small, economically challenged communities? Why does that matter? Except COVID-19 showed us that all of these conditions then meant that Black people and Brown people in this country are not dealing with a global pandemic, right? So we talk about a global pandemic, but we're really talking about white America. For Black America, it's about a syndemic, because we have multiple points of oppression that are coming at us at one time that we're trying to live through and survive through and trying to struggle through and trying to reconcile ourselves with. I mean, it's just painful to deal with the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Rashard Brooks, and I could just keep going, just in the last couple of months, while trying to stay alive and knowing that we have family members and friends who have been impacted either in catching COVID-19 or not surviving their battle with COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. What gives you hope?
So I've been hosting Today with Dr. K for 3 years. We just celebrated our 3-year anniversary. And when I first started on the radio, I was excited about having this platform, about being able to come into people's cars and homes and to really talk about all the things that I think are interesting, right? In a very quirky way of looking at the world. And over time, I found a way for the radio station, my radio show, to be a point of activism for me. So when teachers called and told us that they didn't have enough supplies, then I launched the Today with Dr. K Teacher Depot. And I asked everyone in Baltimore City to come to Morgan State University, to where we were located, where the radio station is. I said, if everyone just brings one case of water, one case of sanitizer, and one case of paper towels or toilet tissue, we can make sure that every child in this city could have the basic needs met, that they can get just the little things that they need in order to be able to go forward without having to think about the ways in which we are struggling in this city. And when I started having all of these young people call, I then launched my Itty Bitty Fan Club, because we started finding out that we had listeners every day who were, so interesting. We had listeners who were as young as 18 months. Their parents would put them in front of the radio to listen. So I started hosting these sessions once a month where we'd get together at a bookstore over on Hartford Road in the Hamilton neighborhood, and I would read books to them, to the Itty Bitty Fan Club. And then when we found that a neighborhood did not have water, then we used the show to rally people around the country to send money so we could buy water and we could make sure they had food, that we were using the show as an activist base. And in January, when I received word about COVID-19 and I received word from a South Korean exchange student who used to live with us, contacted us in December and said, something's coming and you need to be ready for it. I just talked to my producer about making sure that every single day, starting in January, we started talking about COVID-19. And we had a lot of people complain. You keep talking about this thing. It's, you know, it's not really even happening here. But we started telling people, get ready, get supplies. And then to find out that so many people complained about us. They told me, hey, Dr. K, I was so angry with you, but I went and bought these supplies anyway. I went and got the groceries. I went and got the face mask because you kept saying it. And now we're saying thank you because we made sure we had what we needed because you kept telling us. So the show has become a lifesaver for me. The show gives me a lot of hope to be able to have that space to speak to people and to make sure that my community is wrestling with issues that just might save our lives. It might make us think and might make us push a little bit harder.
Terrific. And that's a great way for us to close out our episode here. We want to thank Dr. Kay Whitehead for joining us to talk about her story and her life since she shared it in 2015. And you can tune in to Today with Dr. Kay on WEAA-FM to hear her every day. We want to thank The Wine Source in Hamden. They are a great sponsor of The Soup. We want to thank Maureen Harvey. And we want to let you know that on Thursday, October 15th, we will be having a Soup show called Invisible Labor with a partnership with the Baltimore Museum of Industry. It's a live broadcast from the museum, and then you can watch it online via Zoom. So you can get all the information on that show at soupstorytelling.com. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you, Dr. K, and we'll see you guys in a couple weeks.
Take care, everybody. Stay safe.
When I say